They got down here to this point here, and they just couldn't keep it in the air any longer and set it down on the roadway.
A Cessna lands on an Anchorage city street. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, January 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Murkowski wants more flexibility on energy exports.
We will not be able to access these incredible reserves unless we've got the infrastructure to move it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Older Persons Action Group, publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families, can be read online at seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
A small plane had to make an emergency landing this afternoon on a street in East Anchorage. Anchorage Police Department Lieutenant Mark Thielen says the pilot of the Cessna 172 Cutlass experienced engine trouble shortly after taking off from Merrill Field.
They basically flew right up Boniface here in case they lost power completely. They didn't want to try to go over houses and whatnot, so in case they had to come down on the road. They got down here to this point here, and they just couldn't keep it in the air any longer and set it down on the roadway.
APD says neither the pilot nor the two passengers were injured, and the plane did not hit any vehicles as it landed. The NTSB is investigating the incident. To see a photo of the plane, go to alaskapublic.org. The Coast Guard icebreaker Polar Star is standing down from a rescue mission in Antarctica today after the vessels it was going to assist broke free on their own. The Polar Star had been called in to clear a path for two icebound vessels, a Russian research ship and a Chinese icebreaker. The Polar Star departed Australia for Antarctica on Saturday and would have arrived on scene this week. Or next week. Allison Conroy, the Coast Guard's chief warrant officer for the Pacific area, says the stranded ships got favorable winds today and were able to break out of the ice on their own. She says the ships are now in open water. That means the Polar Star's services are no longer needed. Conroy says the icebreaker will now continue on to its primary mission in Antarctica to resupply the U.S. Antarctic Program's McMurdo Station. It's the first time the cutter has returned to Antarctica since 2006. The Polar Star is the Coast Guard's only active heavy-duty icebreaker. It recently had a major overhaul, and it made a stop in Unalaska last June before undergoing ice trials in the Arctic. It's home-ported in Seattle. Senator Lisa Murkowski today called for lifting the decades-old ban on crude exports. In a speech to the Brookings Institution, she said the oil boom in North Dakota and elsewhere in the lower 48 calls for a wholesale review of the country's energy export rules. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
The oil export ban was imposed in a time of scarcity, and just a few years ago, lifting it would have been politically impossible. But with the boom underway, the industry has been arguing the ban has outlived any usefulness. And Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz also suggested last month it's out of date. Murkowski says the rules need to change to encourage the export of crude and other kinds of energy as well.
The regulatory edifice that governs the export of American-made energy is antiquated and at times, I would suggest, even absurd.
Murkowski says if the country doesn't act, the light North Dakota oil will soon create a glut on the market, in part because much of the nation's refining capacity is concentrated on the Gulf Coast and set up to handle heavier crude. Murkowski's not proposing a comprehensive energy export bill. She says the executive branch has the authority to change most of the rules, but she says she can introduce smaller targeted bills if needed. One of her stated goals with the speech and with a 20-page white paper she released today is to kick off debate in Congress. The crude export ban is not absolute. Congress lifted it in 1995 for oil coming from the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And for the next 8 years, less than 3% of Alaska's output was exported to foreign countries. But then the state's production declined, the industry consolidated, and the U.S. Energy Information Administration says no Alaska crude has been exported in a decade. But it remains legal to export North Slope oil, so lifting the national ban would have no direct effect on Alaska. Murkowski is the top Republican on the Senate Energy Committee. In her speech and during Q&A afterward, she raised several energy policy issues. One of her points is that the country will lose out if it doesn't invest in energy infrastructure.
We will not be able to access these incredible reserves unless we've got the infrastructure to move it. And this is not just limited to our fossil fuels. It's how we move our wind, our solar, our renewables. This is going to be our big challenge moving forward, and it's going to be expensive.
Just look at Alaska, she says. The state has vast amounts of coal and natural gas, but no way to move it to market.
You know, we were successful in the mid-70s, thank goodness, of getting the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. But that really has been our only infrastructure corridor, is that 800-mile pipe.
Any move to lift the export ban will face opposition from refiners that aren't also in the oil production business. The chemical industry has spoken against it, as have consumer groups who say it will raise the price of gasoline. Tyson Slocum, director of energy for the group Public Citizen, says allowing crude exports would be great for oil companies but bad for American drivers.
By simply doing away with the ban on exporting raw crude oil, you are going to harm U.S. manufacturing and basically turn our economy into a model that Nigeria and Russia pursue, which is simply exporting raw products.
Industry advocates say there's no evidence ending the ban would raise prices for consumers. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
State regulations take effect next month that further define what constitutes a medically necessary abortion for purposes of receiving Medicaid funding. Notice was sent to the state health department today. The new rules, blasted by critics as unconstitutional, take effect February 2nd. The new certificate to request Medicaid funds features two boxes. The provider would have to certify the pregnancy was the result of rape or incest, or the abortion was performed to save the woman's life. Or the provider would have to indicate an abortion was medically necessary to avoid a threat of serious risk to the woman's physical health from continuation of her pregnancy. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, virtually visiting the Anchorage Museum.
Kids that are a lot younger than I am certainly rapidly identify with technology, and the world is changing when it comes to that.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Judge Sen Tan has announced that he will be stepping down from the bench. In a brief letter sent yesterday, the Anchorage Superior Court judge informed Governor Sean Parnell that his retirement would be effective on July 1st. Tan did not give a specific reason for leaving his post or supply information on his future plans. Tan has served as a Superior Court judge since 1997. Larry Cohn, who directs the Alaska Judicial Council, says Tan earned high marks through his career.
Judge Tan has consistently received very high ratings from those who are most familiar with his professional work as a judge, including attorneys and law enforcement officers and court employees and jurors.
While Tan was respected in the legal world, a conservative advocacy group campaigned for his removal in 2012. Alaska Family Action urged voters to oppose Tan's retention because of a ruling concerning abortion that he made in the late 1990s. Tan ultimately secured 55% of the vote. Cohn doesn't think that Tan's retention should have been politicized.
To those critics who are dissatisfied with the content of decisions he's made, I mean, we strive to have impartial and fair judges and independent judges who follow the law, and the law is not necessarily popular.
The Alaska Judicial Council will be taking applications for the judgeship through February. The group plans to provide its recommendations to the governor in June. Due to hefty cuts in Governor Parnell's proposed capital budget, the Susitna-Watana Hydroelectric Project is having its timeline pushed back by 4 months. KTNA's Philip Manning has been following the story and has this report.
Last month, the Alaska Energy Authority learned that it would be receiving less than 10% of the funding it would need to complete the studies and other pre-licensing steps for the Susitna-Watana Project. In a press release on Monday, AEA says that $110 million will be needed, but Governor Parnell's proposed budget provides for just $10 million. Now AEA is pushing back the timeline by 4 months, beginning with the initial study report that was originally scheduled for next month. That report will now be considered a draft, with the final report coming in June. AEA spokeswoman Emily Ford explains what the extended timeline is intended to do.
And that part would include our efforts for this coming field season and next. So essentially, it gives stakeholders a little bit more time to be able to understand the study results and for us to more effectively communicate and then also participate in the prioritization effort for upcoming studies as well.
Pushing the initial report back by 120 days also means that the final application to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission will be filed in early 2016 as opposed to the fall of 2015 as originally planned. Mike Wood, president of the Susitna River Coalition, a Talkeetna-based group opposing the dam, applauds the move by AEA and says it's a good thing that stakeholders will have more time to digest the findings of the report. He says that the coalition has believed all along that AEA's initial time frame was too short. Part of the delay also comes down to there not being enough money to do all the environmental studies that were initially planned for the fiscal year beginning in July. Emily Ford says the process will continue moving forward, however.
What we'll be doing is looking at that $10 million figure, looking at our upcoming field season, prioritizing those efforts, and then if additional funds are available through the process, then looking at 2015 and implementing a full field season.
When discussing the cuts to Susitna-Watana's budget, Governor Parnell cited a lack of progress on access to land owned by Alaska Native corporations as a major reason for cutting funding. Emily Ford says that obtaining land access is also an ongoing process.
AEA and the Cook Inlet Region Group, I think it's safe to say we both remain committed to advancing these negotiations for land access, and there is progress. It may not be as quick as some had expected, but there is forward momentum and there is progress, and we're continuing to build that relationship and strengthen that relationship for the short term and the long term.
While AEA's letter to FERC hints that there may be more money available in the fiscal year 2015 budget, statements by Senators Pete Kelly and Mike Dunleavy indicate that it would be difficult to find additional funds when the state budget is already relying on over $1 billion in reserve spending. Emily Ford says that AEA is not assuming any additional funding will become available this year.
What we're doing is assuming that the $10 million is the final budget amount. We're making that assumption, and we're taking existing funds that we have and looking to prioritize our field efforts. So we're not working under any assumptions of additional funds.
If approved by FERC, the extension that AEA is requesting for the Susitna-Watana project means that there is more time for the governor and legislature to potentially provide funding in the budget for fiscal year 2016. Until then, work on the project will be limited to what's left of fiscal year 2014's $95 million budget in addition to the $10 million for fiscal year 2015. Based on AEA's letter and statements, it's safe to say that while the hydroelectric megaproject has suffered a significant setback, AEA believes it is far from dead in the water. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Just weeks after top executives for Buccaneer Alaska were fired, the company is making moves to shore up its financial situation. KDLL's Shailen Cochran reports.
In a news release Wednesday, the company said it was selling off the rest of its 25% interest in the Cosmopolitan drilling project just off Anchor Point for $41 million. The sale will replace Buccaneer's small interest in the project with needed cash assets. Fort Worth, Texas-based Blue Crest Energy already owned the other 75% and will now have complete control of the project. The Endeavor jackup rig is at the heart of the Cosmo unit, and as part of the deal, Blue Crest Energy is on the hook to keep using the rig for another 150 days to be split up in 50-day increments during winter drilling seasons. Those seasons run from November through April. The Endeavor is currently in Port Graham, awaiting approval to get back to work. Related to that sale is Buccaneer's offloading of half of its interest in Kenai Offshore Ventures. That's the partnership between Buccaneer, a Singapore-based investment firm called Ezion Holdings, and Alaska taxpayers who helped fund the purchase of the rig through the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. Buccaneer's share of the venture will go to a subsidiary of the Singapore outfit for $24 million. Buccaneer officials again did not return calls for comment about the sales, but according to the news release, the goal of that sale is to jettison its ownership of the rig but still use it for drilling operations. A call to the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority for comment wasn't returned in time for this story either. And finally, Buccaneer has found itself another fresh injection of capital to continue with other projects. A short-term $6 million loan was made available by Chicago investment firm Meridian Capital. Meridian also extended a $50 million line of credit to Buccaneer, and that's in addition to the $100 million Meridian put up back in July. During the two-plus years, Buccaneer has been working around Cook Inlet. Its only production to market has come from the Kenai Loop wells, putting out close to 5 billion cubic feet of natural gas since coming online. Those operations could be in jeopardy, too, though. Court hearings are scheduled for later this month to settle ownership disputes about the wells between Buccaneer, Cook Inlet Region Incorporated, and the Alaska Mental Health Trust. Reporting from Kenai, I'm Shailen Cochran.
This week, you can travel to the Anchorage Museum without going further than the local public library. KSTK's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
Aaron Leggett is the special exhibits curator at the Anchorage Museum, and he'll be giving a very special presentation on an exhibit this week.
I'm one of the co-curators on an exhibition here at the Anchorage Museum called Dena'inak, Uch'ul Yashid, the Dena'ina Way of Living. It's the first comprehensive exhibit ever done on the Dena'ina Athabascans, the indigenous people of South Central Alaska. And I myself am Dena'ina.
He'll be sharing the objects and stories of the exhibition, as well as online resources and tools for educators. And here's the catch. He'll be in Anchorage at the exhibit, and his audience will be in libraries across the state. K.J. Bush is the director of the Irene Engel Public Library. She says the library is using technology to span the distance.
About 3 or 4 years ago, the library became a part of what's called OWL, which is stands for Online with Libraries. And basically, it's a program to implement quite a few different technologies in the public libraries around the state.
A portion of the grant provided for new video conferencing equipment. Jay Bush says the people who attend the presentation will be active participants.
They will be taken into the library's meeting room because it is a video conference. So it is presented on a large screen and is going to be presented from the Anchorage Museum. And there will be other communities joining the video conference.
Curator Leggett says a video conference doesn't quite give the same sensory experience of actually being in the museum's exhibit, but his presentation combined with the interactive exhibit online is a good way to engage with a wider audience.
More, I'm excited. I'm just excited that more people will be able to at least become aware of the exhibition. The resources that are available.
After Leggett's presentation, there is a planned Q&A session with audience members from around the state. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
The presentation on the Dena'ina Way of Living is scheduled for tomorrow, Wednesday, January 8th at 7 p.m.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Public Education Health Trust, formerly NEA Alaska Health Plan, delivers cost-effective health plans for Alaska families. They help Alaska's educational professionals, from school bus drivers to teachers, manage their health plan benefits efficiently. Public Education Health Trust provides members with low-cost plans, more choices, and local control, advocating for 17,000 Alaskans and their health care needs. This message sponsored by Public Education Health Trust.
The umbrella name Era Alaska brought together Hagland Aviation, Era Aviation, and Frontier Flying Service 5 years ago. That's history now. As KYUK's Ben Matheson reports, the new year brings a new name for the combined flying service.
Era Alaska is no more. It's now Raven Alaska. That is R-A-V-N. You leave out the E. CEO Bob Hadukovich says the name fits what the company is setting out to do.
The Raven, you know, really covers the whole state of Alaska. It's prolific, it's strong, it's smart, it's efficient, all the things we want to be. So in that regard, it was kind of like the perfect mascot, for lack of a better term.
The name change has been in the works for several months. When Era came together back in 2009, there was a company for helicopters and one for the airlines. Last January, the independent Era Helicopters went public and began to advertise nationally.
So the confusion between the two names kind of came to a discussion point where it just made sense to try to change our name, because we had really become a lot more than what Era was originally and the history of Era.
The State Department of Transportation must approve the registration, then Era can do business as Raven Alaska. There will be a new logo of a raven in flight. Passengers will see those on the aircraft tails over the next 12 months. Raven is the name to remember, but the companies that make up the Raven family still retain some identity, at least on paper. Era Aviation's corporate name is now Corvus Airlines, that's actually Latin for Raven, and Frontier Flying Service and Hagland Aviation are now flying as Raven Connect. That's supposed to reflect the nature of smaller commuter aircraft trips. The change comes as many are still struggling with the aftermath of the fatal crash of a Cessna 208 outside St. Mary's. Hadukovich says the name change is unrelated.
That hit us close to home with us. It was a very personal event for a lot of our company, and we don't want to diminish the trauma of that and the anxiety. It's from that timing standpoint, it's just awkward. But we've been planning this for the last 8 months, certainly.
People can contact the airline at its usual phone numbers and at flyraven.com. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
The city and borough of Juneau has yet to join the more than 1 billion online users of Facebook. While city employees may be personal users, most don't use it in a professional capacity to interact with the public. Now the city of Juneau is in the initial stages of developing a social media policy. And like many municipal governments around the country, it's struggling with the best way to get information to the public in the most efficient and accurate manner. KTOO's Lisa Fu has the story.
We're kind of in this, like, social media limbo right now.
Lori Sika is clerk for the City and Borough of Juneau. She's helping to develop a social media policy and admits she has a lot to learn.
I'm learning how to use Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, what else? Instagram, Pinterest. There's just tons of them. I've just been trying to get up to speed so that I can speak intelligently about it and how it's used. These things change so fast. It's like, ugh.
Until the City and Borough of Juneau has a social media policy, city departments are not to open accounts on sites like Facebook and Twitter. Those that already use social media, like Juneau Public Libraries and Eagle Crest Ski Area, can continue to do so. Sika says there's a lot to consider when developing a social media policy for government use, like how much staff time should be allocated to using it.
What happens if staff update the city's Twitter account from home? Oh my gosh, they're working. I have to pay them. That kind of stuff, you know.
Juneau Public Library's director Robert Barr doesn't consider social media much of a time suck for his staff.
It's not a whole lot of effort on behalf of staff. We just kind of lump it into our typical promotional efforts. This is just one more checkbox on the list. Just do a quick post on Facebook.
The public library system has had an internal social media policy since June 2011. It has a Facebook page, a Twitter account, and a blog. City Manager Kim Kiefer knows it's time for Juno to establish a policy that allows other departments to be active online.
We're behind the curve for sure with social media. In government, we need to try and reach out to everybody in the community, and I think we're probably missing a group of the population because they don't go to Juno.org to get information. They want it yesterday, and I don't know that we're providing it to them in a way that they can get it.
The city of Fairbanks has had a social media presence since March 2010 and an internal city policy for 6 months. Public Information Officer Amber Courtney says the social media policy makes sure all information is shared in a positive and honest manner.
It's just ensuring that we have a level of trust with the people who are sharing the information to make sure that our tone is always professional and respectful, that we're cognizant of the things that we're sharing and how they're going to impact the public. For example, we definitely don't want people sharing photos of accident scenes where somebody might have been injured.
In Fairbanks, the city, police department, emergency communications center, and mass transit are all on Facebook. Other departments that want to set up an account must get approval from the mayor. The push for Fairbanks to get on social media stemmed from attending FEMA workshops. Courtney learned that the public relied on Facebook and Twitter to get information from the government about disasters and emergencies.
And so I thought, well, we definitely need to kick that into gear and start building our audience so that should something untoward happen, we have access to as many people as possible. And I know that that information goes exponentially. There's 44,000 people within a 10-mile radius of where I sit that have a Facebook account. So if I can get to 10% of them, that's amazing because it just goes from there.
The city of Fairbanks has more than 340 likes on its Facebook page, which Courtney hopes will grow to at least 10 times that. She says posting information about snow removal doubled the city's Twitter followers, now at more than 800. Courtney will soon have more time to grow the audience on both sites. Her job duties have recently shifted to make social media a primary responsibility. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andy Ropeek in Unalaska, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Shady Grove Oliver in Wrangell, Ben Matheson in Bethel, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. APRN's Josh Edge reported from Anchorage, Alexandra Gutierrez from Juneau, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Quality Inn and Suites on Spinard, providing lodging for Medicare patients in Anchorage with a 24-hour airport shuttle and a hot continental breakfast. Reservations at 800-221-7550. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through PicClickGive or contributing to a college savings plan. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority would like to recognize businesses and organizations that employ Alaskans who experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, and mental health conditions. When you hire a mental health trust beneficiary, you're not just providing a job, you're providing an opportunity to showcase unique skills, a strong work ethic, and a desire to succeed. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.